Welcome to The Latest on the Law, a podcast of the Boston Bar Association. The Commonwealth's premier legal association, the BBA is home to over 15,000 members and 140 institutional partners consisting of law firms, corporations, government agencies, legal aid organizations, and law schools. Visit us at bostonbar.org to learn more.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome. My name is Eric Kinane. I'm one of the co-chairs of the Estate Planning Committee. We're very excited for today's program, which is being sponsored by both the Estate Planning Committee and the Trust Administration Committee, and is going to involve a discussion related to planning opportunities for leaving family vacation property to future generations, and of course, the potential pitfalls that one may encounter along the way. So with that, I want to introduce one of today's speakers, Gary Ronan, who is my colleague at Goulston & Storrs. Gary is a director at the firm and is a versatile litigator who has extensive experience in probate litigation matters. So certainly looking forward to getting his perspective on today's topic. I will now turn it over to Nathan Bress, who's the co-chair of the Trust Administration Committee, so that he can introduce our other speaker for today's program and that we can get right into it. Nathan?
All right. Thank you, Eric. As Eric mentioned, I'm Nathan Bress. I'm a co-chair of the Trust Admin Committee, and I'm introducing Bill Moran. Bill is a partner at Bass, Doherty & Finks, and he specializes in all sorts of trusts and estates planning matters. I will turn it over to the two of you.
Great. All right. Thank you very much, everybody. So today we're going to talk about family vacation homes. We're going to talk about planning for them, and we're going to talk about all the things that can go wrong and how you can try to address them when you're doing planning. If we go to the second slide, please. This is why we think this topic is interesting. It's really estate planning on steroids because of the dynamics that are particular to planning around vacation homes, whether they're vacation homes or other family homes, because there are some unique characteristics of those things, right? It's a physical space. It's a piece of real property where you expect, as the donor, or that your descendants are going to go, and they're going to spend time with each other. They're going to be together in close proximity to one another, or they might be competing to use that home in various parts of the year. So there's a dynamic there that's different from a stock or a bond or even a company shares in the family company. And it's also something that sometimes comes with some history with members of the family, right? They grew up going to the summer house in Maine together. They have memories about that. So those things matter. And in addition, there are what can be relatively complicated economic components to what you need to worry about and plan for too. How is it going to be kept up? Who's going to pay for it? Who's in charge? Who makes decisions? So we're going to talk about all those things, which inform why we think this is an interesting topic. The other thing to say here is that because of the complexities of this, success is not a one-size-fits-all concept. You really need to talk with your clients to make sure that you understand their objectives, but also to make sure they understand the way these things can play out over the years so that they can make informed decisions about how to address the various things that you need to plan for in order to create a likelihood that this is going to be a successful endeavor for them and their families. Do you want to say something more about this, Bill, before we go to the next slide?
I agree, Gary. I think the dynamics for every family and every property are unique. The financial considerations, the emotional considerations, and the family dynamics. Understanding what the goals are from the G1 or the current property owners, and whether it's practical for subsequent generations to share this property, and is it something that's going to be, tried to be held in the family forever, or just one generation, or further down the road? So having open conversations about all of the dynamics we're going to talk through is going to be critical for success, and success in one family or for one client may look completely different than the next client. And there's a lot of pitfalls. So manage expectations as you start these conversations. So.
Yep. Yeah. And let's go to the next slide. We'll talk about some of the pitfalls here because, you know, I'm the litigator, so I always like to talk about things that are going to go wrong. And what can go wrong in this situation? Everything. Everything can go wrong. Imagine a world in which, you know, your clients are going to leave the family house in Maine or Florida or wherever to their kids and their grandkids because they envision, oh, it's going to be great. Everybody's going to go there in the summer and spend time together. And it's going to build the bonds among my grandchildren and their grandchildren for generations to come. And more often than not, in my experience, although my experience is somewhat shaded by what I do, it doesn't work out that way. And for reasons that you can understand, I mean, people are going to have different interests in the house in the future. People are going to have different economic circumstances from one another. Their relationships among them may not always be what the grantor, your clients, think that they're going to be or hope that they're going to be. And so there's a lot that can go wrong. And this is another reason, you know, we talked about some of the things on this slide here, but this is another reason why we think, Bill and I both think, that you really need to explore all of this with your clients and probe their assumptions about what they think their kids and grandkids might like or may not like in terms of whether not only how to leave a vacation property for them, but even whether to do it in the first place. Because your client may think, oh, the family's going to love this, but the family may not love this. Or even if the family thinks it's a good idea now, they may not have thought through all the things that might happen down the road that will cause problems for them.
And on that, Gary, just wanted to frame this question and the planning regarding these types of properties around the thought that I often tell clients, obviously, this place means a great deal to you, and it means something different to each member of the family. But what you want to make sure is that this place that's so special for the family isn't the catalyst to that potential litigation, right? You don't want the place that is so special and where there's been so many great memories to be the thing that, you know, triggers family members not talking to one another for, you know, multiple generations because, you know, we didn't ask the right questions and prepare for the foreseeable future.
Right. So if we go to the next slide, we've talked about this a bit so far, but, you know, you keep in mind there's some emotional dynamics here that matter in that people, especially if this is a property that's been in the family for a while, the children and grandchildren may have connections to it. They may have memories of when they were growing up. They may have strong feelings about whether they like this property or not, whether they want to spend time there and those sorts of things. And it's one of the reasons why I would suggest, and I know Bill agrees, that you ought to talk not just with your clients who are doing the planning about what they foresee will be the use of this property in the future, but you ought to encourage them to involve their kids and to the extent they're adults, the grandchildren as well. Because people may have strong feelings about this particular property or more generally about the idea of having a family property left to them in a particular way that don't line up with each other and with what your clients think. And so it really can be beneficial to involve as many of these people as you can in the discussion, because you're going to equip your clients and be able to make a more well-informed decision about whether to leave a property at all. And if so, how to structure it and what sort of guardrails you want to put around things to try to minimize the possibility of tensions in the future.
One item I just wanted to follow up on, a housekeeping item. As I think Trent said at the beginning of the program, if there are any specific questions that you'd like to ask during the program, you can fill out the questions on the Q&A feature on the Zoom. If there's something that we think applies to the conversation generally, then we'll certainly like to address it during the conversation. But otherwise, we're happy to follow up on specific questions after the fact. I think for purposes of the conversations with the family, I think the easiest thing to talk about is the financial considerations, right? You know, we have balance sheets in front of us when we're talking with clients. We see where all of the pieces are. We see, you know, where they have liquid assets, where they have illiquid assets, where all of those assets are located, what the potential estate tax liability may be. And we have to be really thoughtful about the planning for this illiquid asset, because as Gary said, it's not like you're dividing a $10 million stock portfolio, right? The $10 million home in Nantucket or the $100,000 cabin in the woods doesn't divide as easily as the stock portfolio or the bank account. So we also have to think about how we're going to transfer this property if there are state or federal estate tax considerations, right? Is there going to be a gift of the property during lifetime? Or is it something where the G1 is going to hold on to the property and it's going to be included in their estate for estate tax purposes? So there are drawbacks to both, right? And if you're appreciation and real estate, especially vacation homes, in the recent decades, has been tremendous. And so G1 may have bought the property decades ago. And if they were to gift the property during their lifetime, it would have that carryover basis. And so if G2 sells the property, they may trigger capital gain taxes that would exceed the state estate taxes if G1 had just kept the property in their estate and had it been subject to estate taxes. So while G1 may have this idea of, well, I know what's going to happen with the property, I'm going to tell them what to do, they're going to love coming here and gifts it during lifetime, had they had a conversation with their children or adult grandchildren and realized, no, actually, they're going to sell it, then maybe don't gift it during lifetime. Maybe getting that step up in basis and mitigating capital gain taxes would actually be a better approach, especially with the mass millionaires tax and higher state income taxes these days. If there is going to be gifting during lifetime, it may be that you're using the typical tools that we as planners will use, whether it's a QPERT or a lifetime direct gift or swap into a grantor trust. But knowing the cost basis, knowing what that carryover basis would be if there is a lifetime gift of the property, or if there's going to be, you know, retaining the property until death, is there sufficient liquid assets within the estate or in other family trusts that would be available to pay the estate tax liability is a critical component of the planning conversation. The other financial consideration is, you know, in addition to, can the kids each afford to own a portion of a home? What are the ongoing carrying costs, right? And who's going to be responsible for those? If you're planning during lifetime and the G1 is giving the property away and they continue to use the property, then you might consider having them lease the property from the trust if they've given it to a trust. That way, one, you mitigate the chances that the IRS or the DOR, if it's a mass property, try to pull the property back into G1's estate for estate taxes. But the very real concern of if a trust owns the property, how are we getting cash into the trust to pay for the insurance, to pay for the maintenance expenses, to pay for ongoing carrying costs like real estate taxes. If the trust doesn't have that cash to and other liquid assets to pay those expenses, then how are we going to get assets into the trust? Are there going to be capital contributions, or are family members going to have to rent it? Otherwise, you have the trustee with a lot of bills and no cash, which may trigger the requirement of selling the property, even if that's not the intent. So if client's going to set aside the property in trust for next generation, how are those expenses going to be paid? And we'll talk about some options for those considerations. There's also a lot of legal pitfalls that you can come into. A few weeks ago, just inherited an estate plan from that a client came over, and their trustee of a trust that owns a home of which 12 siblings share, and there's 12 separate shares for this trust. And distributions are supposed to be made to each of the beneficiaries on an annual basis. And the only thing that the trust owns is a house on the water. And only two of the 12 siblings actually use the property. So my client is the trustee, and we have to navigate a way to how they're going to hold this house for the benefit of 12 beneficiaries, but only two of them are using. The other 10 beneficiaries, you know, may come back and say, well, where is my portion of the rent? You should have been renting this out to a third party. You should have been making this property productive. There is a purpose trust that's funded with cash, a small endowment to cover the expenses, but that doesn't relieve my client of their fiduciary duty to maximize the assets that are in the trust and make them profitable for her siblings. So the structure of the entity, either that you're designing as a planner or that you may inherit from another firm who is no longer sitting at the table, may not match the responsibilities that the fiduciaries may have for managing the property for beneficiaries.
Yeah, I want to just jump in to underscore this point, because in my view, it's pretty much inevitable that with the passage of enough time, you're going to get in a situation, if the house is in a trust or an LLC, whatever the structure is, where the not all the beneficiaries are aligned in terms of their desire to use the house. You're going to have the situation where some are using, some are not, some are interested, some are not in using, some are not, and some would rather cash out. I would recommend that you have to think about escape valves in your planning to allow those kinds of situations to be addressed, because they're really inevitable at some point. Maybe not in the first, you know, maybe not in G2 when it's just the three siblings, but when you get to their kids and their grandkids, it's almost inevitable you're going to have this issue.
Absolutely. And, you know, there are a lot of tools available to us, but in the case that I mentioned, we're likely going to reach out to all of the beneficiaries and maybe have them sign a non-judicial settlement agreement and have the trust with separate shares transfer the property into the purpose trust that has the endowment funds for the carrying cost. But that's only if everybody's on the same page. And if not, then, you know, we're going to have a more difficult process unwinding this. So, and of the 12, my guess is that there's going to be one squeaky wheel who's looking for a payday. So, fingers crossed. There's also a lot of fiduciary considerations. As I mentioned, my client's in this position that, you know, she's doing this to try to carry out her parents' wishes, but they've put her in a bad spot. And if you have a family member who's serving as a trustee, yeah, there may be a conflict of interest. They're making decisions on the use and enjoyment of the property. My client refuses to stay there if she and her husband don't stay there. But her children may want to stay there, right? And if she's controlling the calendar and the use of the property, there's going to lead to either infighting or someone pointing to her and saying, you know what, your fiduciary duty should preclude you from favoring yourself or your own children in terms of the use and enjoyment of the property, or you have substantial means, you don't necessarily need the assets that are in this trust. I do. I'd like you to sell the property and make the property productive and be making distributions of the rent. You also may run into a situation where G1 is thinking about a corporate or a professional trustee, someone outside the family, in order to eliminate or address some of those potential conflicts of interest. But in my experience, corporate trustees don't want to have anything to do with owning real estate, and certainly not residential real estate that's not productive, right? And I think professional trustees are likely going to look at, you know, this dynamic and say, you know, pass. This is something for the family to work out amongst themselves. You know, we don't do what we do in order to become, you know, keepers of the calendar of who gets to use the property on 4th of July. At least I haven't. So thinking about who would actually be the fiduciary here and setting them up for success, so that we don't have to call Gary when there's infighting, is a critical piece to consider.
But if there is infighting, please do call me.
So this may just be generational, but I think, you know, as a parent myself, I think I know exactly what's in the best interest of my children and how to set them up for success and, you know, how they should enjoy spending time with one another. So I think the most important thing we can do as planners is really understand our clients, and can't really understand them unless we've challenged their thinking. And understanding, you know, what is it that they're actually looking to accomplish here, right? And it may be that there's a particular property, a particular home that is so meaningful that, you know, the client's goal is actually to keep this specific property in the family for as long as they can, or for the next generation, or whatever their term they have in mind may be. But it may just be that they're looking to, they're thinking of that emotional connection to this place, and they're looking to foster those connections for family members going forward. And so maybe to challenge clients' thinking and say, well, do you really want to preserve this one place and all of these logistic concerns that are going to come into play with owning a property for multiple family members and multiple generations, and what can go wrong, and have this potentially be the catalyst for infighting among the family? Or are you looking to provide a pool of capital for subsequent generations so that they can spend time together, maybe vacation together, maybe just go rent, you know, in a different place every year, spend Thanksgiving together and go out and rent a property. Maybe it's the same property or in the same area, or maybe it's, you know, in different places around the world from year to year. So understanding what it is that they're actually looking to accomplish so that we're not spending a lot of time and energy and funds planning for something that isn't actually the end goal, right?
I think that's right. I'd underscore that point too. I think it, unless it really is, this place is so, this single place is so special, I need it to be remain in my family and be used by my descendants. If that's not the client's driving motivation, there are better options, in my view, that are much less fraught with problems down the road, that require much less planning upfront, and that are much more likely to be successful in accomplishing the client's interest and objective in getting, having harmony and family together this time in the future among people whom sometimes aren't there to speak for themselves at that point in time. And there's just no way to know what the dynamics among that group are going to be 50 years from now. So so I think this is a really important point.
And as Gary and I were having conversations about this, we were workshopping some other names for the seminar. Two options that came to mind were planning for the family vacation home, just sell it, and another one was planning for the vacation home, dream home or house of horrors. Right. Because it could be either. So we want to make sure that if we're going to go down this road, that we understand, truly understand clients' goals and are helping them to achieve those goals as efficiently as possible. So we don't tarnish the memories of their place that they hold so special. So if the clients aren't, don't take your advice to just sell it. And divide up the proceeds, then we want to talk through some planning items to consider and focus on so that we can minimize potential friction in the future. Gary?
Yep, and to that. So the first is, and we've touched on this a bit, but use issues. You have to really talk through with your client and, as we said, hopefully members of the other members of the family, how the use of the property is going to be determined and what people's interests are in using it and how. That turns on a number of factors, not only their interests, but is the house big enough? Is this a house that or a property that only one nuclear family can stay in the time? Or is it a big enough property where multiple families can stay at a time? You also need to think about, well, who exactly is it who has the right to use? Does it include spouses, grandchildren, and other folks like that? Or do you want to limit it in a different way? Does your client want to limit it in a different way? It's also worth keeping in mind age and stage characteristics, how a retired couple wants to use a vacation home may be materially different from how a young couple with kids want to use the property. You have the, even if you're in a situation where things are working out well, everybody gets along, they all want to use the property, which is sort of your ideal situation. You got to figure out who is making determinations and how, and in terms of who gets to use it when, especially popular times of year, 4th of July, depending on where you are, it's a ski area over the winter months. So you have to try to plan for procedures and decision makers who are resolving differences of opinion about who gets to use when and how. In addition to the use issues, there's the money stuff, right? And Bill touched on this, but you really need to make sure you are helping your clients provide enough of a nest egg, if you will, to make sure you can cover all the upkeep that's going to be required for the property. By upkeep, I mean not only physical upkeep and renovations, but taxes, if there becomes a, and also for planning for things that may not be routine, but it's discovered there's a wetlands issue that nobody knew about, and you got to address it. You really need to provide enough of a cushion in the funding to make sure those types of things can be taken care of. Otherwise, you run the risk of being in a situation where family loves the house, they don't want to sell it, but they need to because there's not money to pay for some of these things that come up and that maybe weren't that you didn't contemplate or your client didn't contemplate when he or she or they set up the arrangements. And then there's an overall structuring issue. So there are a number, and I think Bill will speak more to this, but there are a number of different ways in which your clients can leave the home for their family, right? What's the structure going to be? A simple option is tenants in common. Each of my kids gets a quarter share That's a pretty fraught way to do it, as I'm sure most of you know or have thought about, for a variety of reasons. So you're often better putting it in a trust, an LLC. But there are benefits and drawbacks to each of those. And this is maybe a place, Bill, I don't know if you want to speak to that at this point, or you want to talk about that later.
So I think that we'll talk through some of the structures in more detail later and pros and cons. And I think, you know, the donors or generation one's intent is going to likely determine the choice of entity. But you know, to Gary's point, tenants in common is going to lead to all it takes is one person who has a differing point of view as to what should be done to file a petition to partition. And now we're off and running, and there's going to be a 25% haircut that's going to go to the trustee for purposes of unwinding the property, and everyone's going to end up with less. You know, trusts are going to have fiduciary issues that arise and funding considerations. And, you know, LLCs, I think, offer a lot of flexibility, but from the donor's perspective, it may offer too much flexibility. So we'll talk through those pros and cons of those different entities as we go forward with some of the potential solutions.
Yep. And then another decision that comes along with what form you want is who's in charge, essentially. Is it whether it's the trustee or managers of an LLC or some other, you know, agreement, depending on how you're setting it up. You want to think about providing structure for who's making decisions. And then you also want to think about how to address disputes if they arise, and consider and talk with your clients about considering putting in things like some kind of interim clause or some other provisions in whatever the operative document or documents are that address how disputes are handled, and maybe insert some sorts of poison pills, like an interim sort of clause that discourages disputes because someone may lose their interest in the property or in the trust if they bring certain types of challenges. And that's something that's worth thinking through with your clients. We go to the next. This is it's something else you want to think about here. As I said, my view and my experience, you know, at some point there's going to be a dispute about the property, and whether that has to do with use, whether it has to do with whether the fiduciary, trustee, or other is properly keeping it up. These things are going to happen, and so it's worth thinking about talking with your client, the donor, about how does he, she, or they, how would they like this to be resolved, and give them some options about that. And this is part of the decision, I think, about the structure you're going to use, because you have different options depending on what the structure is. But it's something that, you know, often your clients may not want to think about because their view is, oh, this is going to be great. Everybody's going to love it. But you need to sort of make them face the prospect of things not being so great and how they would like those types of situations resolved.
So I think despite the fact that that Gary and I are not very optimistic about the, you know, success that a lot of families will have in terms of keeping properties in the family for a long period of time, I think there are those steps that we've touched on that can set up families for success, depending on how they define success. And it's going to require that you have an informed client who's thought through these dynamics and that you've challenged their thinking so that you've considered the goals for generation one, and as well as gotten feedback from generation two or subsequent generations in terms of their desire to use the home and have shared ownership of a place that they're going to be sharing with siblings, but also, you know, the outlaws, the spouses of their siblings, and as well as nieces and nephews. Gary touched on different use of the property and retirees versus families with young children definitely have different use of the property. I also find that college age family members have a different use of properties that can lead to interesting conversations and sometimes police reports. So all of these things need to be taken into consideration, and just to make sure that we've challenged clients' thinking, they're making an informed decision so that we can plan accordingly for not only a tax-efficient transfer of property or a sale of property, but also so that, you know, we don't have to call Gary when things go south because everyone's going to is looking for litigation. That's a solution.
I just wanted to say this. I think this is a point in the program now where we're going to transition from here are the sort of general considerations and problems that come up to here's some specific tools and concepts you can use to try to address the things that we've been talking about up until this point in the presentation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that we're going to touch on I'm going to go into a little bit more detail on each of these options to consider and the right vehicle or the right structure and the right approach is really going to depend on the specifics of the circumstances for client, both, you know, financial dynamics, family dynamics. And so having these tools available or to consider are going to help you to plan most efficiently for client to help them achieve their goals. The first item is a purpose trust. And purpose trust under Section 409 of the METC allows you to create a trust that doesn't have any specific beneficiaries, but you're creating a trust for a non-charitable specific cause, right, and specific purpose. And the goal of the trust is in this case maybe to keep the property in trust so long as I am donor survived by a single descendant and provide make that property available to them for their use and enjoyment, right? And that type of structure would allow the trustees to manage the property for multiple generations. And it may be, you know, large families that have multiple stakeholders and there'll still be a lot of decisions that will have to be navigated in terms of shared use. But if you have a purpose trust and the purpose of that trust is to manage and hold the property for the enjoyment of all of these family members, then you don't have to, you know, have these separate shares created for specific individuals and have to account to those specific individuals or provide income. So your fiduciary duty as trustee is to not to the specific individuals and have to account for, you know, potential rental income and was that distributed out to the beneficiary. It's your only purpose is to comply with donor's intent of managing the property for as long as possible for their descendants or the class of individuals that they've identified. And we'll talk about this a little bit in more detail in a moment.
On that, I find the purpose trust appealing where you do have a donor who's, that's really their intent. They want this house to be maintained and kept for the family for generations to come, because the trustee or trustees of the future are likely to be family members for the reason Doyle identified earlier. Professional trustees are often hesitant to get involved in these things. And you're making that trustee's job easier because they don't have to deal with this difficult situation where, gosh, you know, half my beneficiaries want me to sell the house and half of want me to keep it. What do I do? So you're resolving that question for them, which makes their job simpler and creates less risk for those of your, you know, grandkids, et cetera, who are going to be the trustees.
Yep, I agree. Another approach would be more of a family business, right? It's, you know, it's you're dealing with a home, but it has a lot of the same considerations that, you know, business does. It has, there's a balance sheet, right? There's a P&L every year of this is what the property was worth and this is what we brought in or this is what we spent. And the navigating the decisions as to how the property is going to be used and the, you know, planning considerations for maintenance and use and whether or not to sell the property down the road is something where an entity like a partnership or an LLC, depending on the tax considerations, lends itself more to those stakeholders in the second generation and subsequent generations being able to manage the property, right? And removing the constructs and constrictions of a trust and allowing for a much more flexible structure for those stakeholders to manage the property and navigate the decisions regarding use and ownership. So we'll talk about those dynamics as well. A third option is something that a number of my clients have employed, which is the idea of buying in. And by buying in, I mean that the beneficiaries, say of G2, would have a period of time after the death of the donors just to make a decision as to what they would want to do with the property, right? Do they want to own the property in common with other family members? And they can each make their own decision. And maybe there are other assets of equivalent value that they would receive in the event that they opt out. And they say, I don't want to own this property in common with my siblings. And so I'm going to take the cash offer as opposed to, you know, continuing to own a portion of this property going forward. And then, you know, another option is just to try to keep it within the family, but say, I'm not going to try to force co-ownership on all of my family members. To the victor go the spoils, right? We're just going to set up, you make a bid, and, you know, maybe it has to be somewhat close within a certain percentage of an appraised value or the value as determined for estate taxes. But ultimately, whichever of the family, you know, member or members has the highest offer, then they'll buy it from the rest of the family members so as to, you know, keep it in the family. Again, this is not an option where it's going to lead to harmony. I think this is a situation where maybe you know that the donor wants to keep the property in the family, and there's already some, you know, either infighting or hard feelings among family members so that you know that co-ownership is not going to work. That may be an option to, again, achieve client's goal of keeping that property in the family. So purpose trust, I mentioned, just in more detail here, right? It's the goal is to achieve a specific purpose. This is really, again, a top-down approach of where you're dictating that this property shall be held pursuant to these terms, and you're empowering the trustee to be able to execute on those donors' goals. And so the class of beneficiaries would have an opportunity to use the property, and you'd have to have more instruction for the trustee in this approach, because if you're providing the instructions or it's going to be a top-down approach, specific instructions in terms of, you know, how properties are used, would the trustee be able to, or, you know, have to rent out to third parties if there isn't sufficient assets, if there aren't, if the property's not been endowed in order to cover operating expenses. So the downside to this approach, and in my view, is that circumstances will change. And so the structure can be somewhat static and not as flexible as, you know, an LLC or a partnership that would give subsequent generations the ability to navigate changing circumstances, either for the property or, for the families, right? So if you have a purpose trust and the trustee is directed to maintain a particular property, and that property is on a, you know, cliff in Nantucket, then it, you know, might fall into the water. But the trustees instructed that the purpose of the trust was to hold this specific property for the benefit of the family. I wouldn't want to be serving as the trustee in that circumstance, right? So, consider the downside of the top down approach, and making sure again that the client's making an informed decision about, you know, what happens next and what could go wrong. The family business model, contributing the property to an LLC either during donor's lifetime, and, you know, lifetime planning, whether you've done some gifting with LLC membership interest, either outright to members or to trust for their benefit. But the LLC, the flexibility of the LLC, and to be able to navigate decisions regarding management, financial decisions, having votes, that entity structure is a lot more flexible than trusts are. So it gives you the opportunity to create the right balance of control in terms of how many votes are going to be required to make certain decisions, in terms of who the managers are going to be, what the budget's going to be, you know, should this renovation happen or not? Should this capital improvement be made or not? You know, are there going to be capital calls from the members? What's the rental rate going to be? What's this calendar going to be? How everyone's going to enjoy and use the property, so that subsequent generations and those stakeholders can make the decisions themselves. If not, you know, are they able to sell to one another or gift the property to one another, right? And either the LLC or trust using this type of model to give the kids the flexibility may have provisions for buy sell, or, you know, you can sell to certain family members, and, you know, maybe there's a built-in discount or requirement for getting an appraisal without regard to any discount for lack of marketability, a lack of control. So you have a lot more flexibility in terms of your approach and how these decisions are made, right? As compared to the purpose trust, the downside of the family business model, from my perspective, is just that the client has to be comfortable with the fact that they're not going to be able to control from the great beyond. Next generations are going to do, you know, be able to make the decisions that they think are in their best interest. More detail here in terms of the option of electing in, and the details here where I've again used this approach for a number of clients was really strong ties to particular properties, and clients were nervous that, you know, they didn't want their children making an emotional decision immediately after they had died. So what we came up with was, let's keep the property in a common pot trust or a common share trust, endow the property with operating expenses for what they projected to be about 3 to 4 years. And then, you know, once during that period, they would have shared use of the property and they'd have to navigate those decisions. And then at the end of that term, they'd have to make a decision of, were they going to want to have shared ownership with siblings going forward, or would they want to have a share of assets of equivalent value that had been set aside in a similar structure as essentially a buyout fund. And if everyone had raised their hand and decides to participate in that shared ownership, they would be covering the expenses themselves, but they would also be receiving the other assets of equivalent value, right? If some of them decide to have the shared ownership and some of them decide to take the cash offer, then, you know, it's those family members who have made the affirmative decision themselves that, yes, that, you know, I want to own property and with all of the potential pitfalls that may come along with that shared ownership and dealing with my siblings and their spouses and their young children and college age children going forward. So rather than a top-down approach, you know, they've made their own decision to participate and continue to manage the property for, you know, their own generation and going forward. Again, it may be a combination of purpose trust with, you know, either an LLC or some other structure. The specific entity is really going to depend on client goals, funding, the financial considerations, the emotional considerations, and how much flexibility G1 wants to give to subsequent generations in order to navigate shared use and ownership of the property.
One thought that I have thinking about these options is they all come with some significant benefits, but significant drawbacks too. And I think there really is not a perfect, certainly not a one-size-fits-all solution for addressing all the challenges that we've identified. And in a way, it's sort of, if your client wants to leave a property like this, it's sort of a pick your poison in terms of where, you know, what your appetite for various risks are and how strongly the client feels about leaving the particular property. I come down on the first bullet point there. It's just generally not a good idea. My personal view, and, you know, I'll let Bill speak for himself, is I would encourage people to try to explain to your clients who want to do this the challenges that it poses, and really explore with them the other alternatives. You know, selling the property, providing a pot of money so that family vacations can happen together, and wherever it is consistent with the client's objectives, to try to move them in that direction.
Yeah, and Gary, as we discussed, I generally agree. I think that it is going to be difficult to be successful if client is looking to keep the property and you know, within the family for a number of generations. And at some point, it's just not going to be sustainable. Either, you know, the family gets too large or the family gets too small, or the financial considerations become prohibitive. I've been reading the Big House about a house in the Colt family on the Cape recently, about a house that's been was in the family for, you know, multiple generations, and navigating those decisions generations after generations. That was a top-down approach, right? And so if your client wants to keep the property in the family, then navigating those decisions, challenging their thinking, getting feedback from the subsequent generations, not necessarily, you know, doing what, you know, the subsequent generations want to do. Right? Ultimately, our clients are going to decide what they want to do, and we're going to help them navigate those and plan accordingly. But making sure that they're making an informed decision, and then thinking through what's the best if you transfer of property and entities to use from our planning toolbox so that we can make the process as efficient as possible and, again, not have what is such an important asset emotionally for so many families not become the catalyst for having to give Gary a call because somebody doesn't like the weeks that they get to use the property in the short New England season for summer or over particular holidays. Hopefully the conversation has been helpful in terms of thinking through, if not the right path forward, because there is no single path to success, but at least the questions to ask and the conversations to have with your clients and to encourage them to have with the subsequent generations in terms of what their goals may be and how we may be able to help them accomplish those goals. So I don't see any questions in the Q&A section, but we can, if anybody would like to ask any questions now, in the next minute or so, we're happy to address those questions now. Otherwise, as I said, you can reach out to either me or Gary via email and let us know if you have any specific questions, either related to the materials, the conversations, or just the subject matter. And happy to help going forward. And appreciate everyone joining us today. And appreciate the BBA and the sections for co-sponsoring the conversation that we've had today.
The BBA is Boston's largest legal network built on justice, community, education, and inclusion. Take advantage of our exclusive Express membership offer and save 50% off BBA membership through August 31st, 2024. Enjoy the full benefits of BBA membership and take advantage of BBA programs and events, discounts on services, access to the full Learn Online library, and much more. This special offer is only available through March 15th, 2024. Use code EXPRESS50 at checkout.